Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, everyone. This is Justine Rotolo, also known as Miss ADD. I want to welcome everyone to the program today on my continuing saga of Addiction Begins with ADD. Before I get my son on, Chris Square and his really, really good friend, Della Taylor, I wanted everybody to know that I run two adult support groups in the Los Angeles area. One is in Torrance, California, located at 2785 Pacific Coast Highway. It's held at the Center for Learning Unlimited, which is a school for children with attention deficit and on the autistic spectrum. And they have been kind enough to donate a room to us every week. And this has been going on now for 5.5 years. It's an incredible group. And I would welcome everybody to come on Wednesday nights from 7:30 till 9. Although, I need to let everybody know that for the next 2 Wednesdays, there won't be a group because it's Christmas Eve and New Year's Eve. The other group that's held in Culver City, California, is on the west side, as we like to call it. That group began in June, this past June, and it's held at 6666 Green Valley Circle, and it's at a location called the Share, S-H-A-R-E building. This is a building that houses a lot of 12-step programs, and they have been kind enough to give us space on Thursday nights from 6 to 7:30, and the next 2 weeks we will not be meeting because it's Christmas Day and New Year's Day. So, without further ado, I'd really like to get Chris and Della on the line. Hi.
Hey.
Hey, Chris. How you doing?
Good. How are you?
Good. And hi, Della.
Hi. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. So, listen, guys, I want to tell you how much this means to me, you doing the show. I've got a continuing theme running of Addiction Begins with ADD, and since I know the two of you. Of course, I know Chris so well because he's my son, but I've come to know and love Della so much and that you both have attention deficit. I just thought what we would start out with is you each individually kind of telling your story of growing up and then getting into the whole addiction. So who would like to start?
No, I'll go ahead.
Okay.
Well, I mean, you know, I was diagnosed with ADD very, very young. Oh, was it seven?
Yes.
Yeah. So, you know, it was funny because nobody could ever tell that I was ADD at school because I would hold it together so hard just because, you know, I didn't want everyone to think that I had an issue. And then when I came home, I would just let it all out.
Yeah.
So I think from a very young age, I was always kind of felt like I didn't really have an outlet for my ADD.
Right.
That was just kind of just a burden.
Oh,
so,
to the family, do you mean?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
So I think that fed into my addiction a little bit when I started drinking and you know, smoking pot from a young age. I think it really helped me to feel better just about everything. You know,
okay,
it was a relief.
Can you expand a little bit on that for people? Because there's a lot of parents that are going to listen to this podcast. And when you say that, like, with a whole family situation, because that's where it all begins, that you kind of didn't, you were a burden. Can you explain that?
Yeah, you know, growing up, I had a very just rigid stepfather, which you know very well.
Right.
And I really felt like, you know, we moved around a lot when I was a kid. So when I was changing schools so much, I didn't want to be that ADD kid in class because I needed to make friends. So I was constantly holding it together in school. And then when I came home, I didn't want to get in trouble because our stepdad, whose name was Ken, he would just be so on top of making sure that I was the way he wanted me to be all the time. So I just felt like, you know, I didn't have I felt like I didn't really have much support. I didn't really know how to deal with what was going on. I mean, tried meds, but that only goes so far.
Right. And I know that at times you've told me that you have felt like we medicated behavior.
Yeah.
Okay. Which, yeah, you know,
there was a time when I really hated medication.
I know. And yeah. Of course, you and I have on the side talked about this, and I told you how sorry I was for keeping Ken around for all those years.
Oh, yeah.
Because I realize now what he did and how terrible that was. So for those of you who are listening, I think it's really, really important to hear what Chris is saying, and that is he did not feel acceptance for who he was. Correct?
Right. Yeah, okay. On top of that, I didn't even know who I was just because I wasn't really getting help with what my real situation was.
Right. Now, I did take you to therapy and we had IEPs and all those other things,
yeah.
But seems like you held back a lot in therapy, kind of wanting the therapist to like you.
Well, yeah, that, and I also just wanted the therapist to think I was okay so he could just tell you that I was fine, so then I was just, you know, off the hook.
Exactly. Okay.
Yeah.
So you started smoking pot when you were 14. Okay. I wasn't very aware of everything. I mean, I found marijuana in your drawer, that, and then I went on a rampage, which I'm really sorry because I'm not sure I handled all that correctly. and that, you know, the interesting thing, and I do want to bring this up, because this is important, that you were diagnosed at 25 with bipolar hypomania, correct?
Right.
Okay.
Yep.
One of the things that I noticed as a kid that you and I have talked about was that nothing was ever enough. Like Christmas morning, it was never enough. We'd go out to eat, and you would order the biggest thing on the menu, which you couldn't finish because you were on a stimulant medication. And Ken would get absolutely crazy over that, which was ridiculous. And so everything was always big with you. I mean, you wanted more and more. And part of that, as I've said, and I think you know this yourself, is that in our population, the dopamine levels are lower than other people. So to get to that happy place can take us a lot more than other people. So that's why we look for food or substances or whatever it's going to take to get us there. Okay.
Yep.
So you started using marijuana, and what would you say maybe I could have done differently during that time, if I could have done anything differently, that would have put you on a different path?
I'm not sure. I don't think, you know, I think the fact that we moved around so much really led me to be friends with a lot of different types of people.
Okay.
And I think that's just what led me to finding marijuana faster. I don't think there was a scenario in which I wouldn't have found pot. So if anything, it was just a little bit sped up by the fact that we were in a new city every 4 years.
Okay,
and,
right.
You know, I don't think there was anything you could have done once I found that to prevent it. I mean, it was like the perfect fix for everything.
The perfect storm. Yeah.
Sure.
So,
yeah. No, it was,
Right. So then when you were 19 years old, I came down one morning and my 90 days of Adderall were missing.
Right.
And I right away knew what happened. And I went upstairs to your room and said, "Did you sell my Adderall?" And of course, you admitted to it, and we came to find out that you had a problem, not only with marijuana, but also with alcohol. And so I gave you a choice at that point in time, and you said, "I'm not going into rehab, I'm 19. And I said, "Okay, then you can pack your bags because I'm not harboring a drug addict or an alcoholic."
Right.
And for those of you who are listening, that sounded good, but I was the biggest enabler in the world. So we took him to rehab, and it wasn't inpatient, it was outpatient. And you were there and in AA for 6 months, and then you left.
Right?
Okay.
Yep.
But I want to just make this point, because I think this is important. You just said this to me last week, and it stuck with me. You said that really helped you find your way back to AA at 27.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. I just want everybody who's listening, if you put your child in rehab at 19 and they fall off the wagon, what's that saying, Chris, in the big book about once you have AA? How does that go?
It's not straight out of the big book. It's just kind of an AA thing. They talk about a head full of AA and a belly full of booze.
Right. So you knew all along after that, even though it got worse and worse and worse, and when you were diagnosed with bipolar disorder, I thought, wow, here we go, here's the answer, but it only got worse. But you knew, I guess you always told me, that you were going to end up back in AA.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if I always knew that, but it was always in the back of my mind.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
So, Della.
Yes.
Can you tell your story?
All right. So I was adopted by my adoptive parents, and shortly thereafter we moved to California, and I was always very outgoing, boisterous, couldn't be contained. And I constantly heard my parents telling me to settle down, calm down, knock it off, you're driving us crazy, all sorts of commentary along those lines, which only articulated to me that something was wrong with me.
Right.
And in high school, I got tested for ADD, and the tester explained to my parents the various options as far as medication or some sort of tutoring. And my parents, for whatever reason, probably for the better at that time, wanted to go the non-medication route. And
okay.
So throughout high school, I went through a series of study skills courses where basically after school, I sat with a teacher and she went over all of my assignments with me, taught me how to keep a planner, taught me how to time myself, just basically making all sorts of different accommodations that would allow me to focus given my ADD diagnosis. So academically, that was helpful. However, once I got to college, I became aware that I would rather take the easy route / not have to do all of the extra work, because I've found with most human beings, if there's a shortcut, we're likely to be tempted to take it. And for me, that what involved taking Adderall and Ritalin that I bought from other students. And at this time, I had basically morphed my ADD outgoing personality into a controlled, managed personality through alcohol and drugs. I basically found those to be an outlet. Whenever I drank or used, I kind of felt like that was my time to numb out, my time to kind of mute all of the voices inside that had more or less formed as a child telling me that I was doing something wrong or that I was a mistake or that various other kind of negative commentary that I had just learned to store in my head. So as I got through college, my addiction grew, especially as I latched closer and closer to the easy ways out, which were drugs and alcohol for me. And that just continued. I mean, my ADD personality was always there, and I just didn't know how to handle it outside of drugs and alcohol. I just found myself pretty outrageous to deal with on a regular basis, and that eventually grew into, you know, me hiding and lying and stealing from my parents and from anyone, really. And, you know, that added to the commentary in my head telling me that I was good for nothing, terrible person, this is the life I deserved. And that all kind of peaked in the last year when I essentially just found myself so depressed and so lost that I found AA and got sober.
Wow. So it's like it's the same theme, excuse me, that Chris was just talking about, and that was the whole idea of in the family more than anything else, just not really feeling like you were good enough, or you were accepted.
I definitely think that was the strongest theme. I constantly felt that, like Chris said, I was a burden to my family. I was always causing them some sort of concern or unhappiness. whether it was because I was sober and acting out because of my ADD, or I was drunk and, you know, breaking rules, laws, et cetera. So they just always seemed to be unhappy with me.
Right. Which I think that causes the voices in the head, which are really the thoughts that come up, that tell us all that we're, you know, not good enough and we can't do this and, you know, how can we cause these issues in our family? And so does the drugs and the alcohol kind of lessen those voices?
Absolutely. For me, at least, initially it did. But over time, that also ceased to work.
So, Chris, did they lessen the voices for you?
Yeah. I mean, lessen the voices, and it also just gave me it made me feel good. You know, I wasn't feeling good about either place that I was at school or at home. So
right.
It was a way for me to, like Della said, to numb out. But also, you know, I felt good about myself when I was high or when I was drunk.
Right.
I think another point for me was that everyone else I surrounded myself who, for the most part, were addicts and alcoholics, from as far as my understanding goes, felt the same way. So there was a camaraderie. People that I was buying drugs for weren't necessarily the happiest, healthiest, smartest people on the planet. And I could relate.
Yeah.
And so buying drugs from them or doing drugs with them seemed right almost, because they were the only people I could relate to as far as why I was using and drinking so constantly.
Right. And the other thing, too, and I want people to understand this, is Chris would always say to me, Mom, you know, you blame everybody else. Because I used to hate Chris's friends. You know, I hate this guy, I hate this girl, and it's not them, it's me. I mean, I'm the one that's saying to them, hey, have a drink, you know, come on, sit down. Oh, you're only going to have one? Have two, you know, and that was hard for me as a parent to listen to because I didn't want to believe it. But as time went on, I began to see that what he was saying was actually true. And that's why I'm saying this, because parents who are listening, I want them to understand that they have to live in the real world. Like living in that big river in Egypt, like I call it, denial, doesn't help the situation at all.
Another thing for me was my parents had a really tough time understanding where or what they could have done differently to prevent what was going on. And my dad had an uncle who went through AA, and he had attended several meetings with him back in the day and had clung to this phrase, which is somewhat old at this point, but is an AA phrase, and that is to find religion. And doesn't necessarily mean religious in the sense that it's most commonly heard today, but just in the sense of finding some purpose, something bigger than yourself. And as my addiction grew and my dad saw that, he was able to kind of step outside of his parental perspective and realize that, like, the change was going to have to come from within me. And there was nothing he could have done or did do or was going to do to force me to do anything, whether he thought it was for the best or whatnot. So it really, like what Chris was saying, where it wasn't his friends, I went through a similar thing where my dad tried to say, don't hang out with so-and-so, or I don't like so-and-so. And, you know, at the end of the day, I was going to do whatever I was going to do based on my path and my, you know, addiction, my alcoholism telling me that I needed to drink. And I was definitely a provoker amongst my friends, too. I constantly would mock people for what I called babysitting their drinks. So it definitely, you know, as far as what you're speaking to parents, it's a really tough situation because there's really nothing that can be done if your child honestly does have an addiction or alcoholism. They just have to know what options there are and then eventually, hopefully, you know, search them out themselves.
But I guess what the question I want to ask the both of you, because I have a lot of clients that will bring their kids in and the kids are smoking pot or they're drinking, and what do you do when you're sitting in front of a kid and the kid's going, I don't have a problem, I don't have any issue, and meanwhile, you know that they do?
I mean, that's really tough.
It's super tough. Even now, on the other end of it, you know, I see people today I picked up a friend's dog down in the Tenderloin who I'm going to be babysitting for the holidays, and I saw a girl just sitting on a few steps shooting some drugs. And I was just sitting, I was holding this dog, and I was just looking at her like, don't you know you don't have to do that? Like, you know, but I also could relate, like, she's probably, has some justification in her sick mind of why she has to do that, whether it's just to maintain her quote-unquote health and stay well and use drugs, or if it's, you know, she really thinks her life is that terrible because she's in her addiction.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, in that moment, there's nothing anyone's going to be able to say that's going to keep her from doing what she's doing. And I was, you know, the same way. I told Chris the other night, I came home one night I drove home one night and walked in my house with an open fifth of Sky, and my dad was waiting up for me, and I just handed it to him and started to walk up to my room, and he was like, are you effing kidding me? You know, you just drove home drunk? And I was like, no, I didn't. And he was like, the car just pulled up. And I was like, I didn't drive tonight, I walked. And he was like, I know you are lying. And there was just no, I couldn't see the truth. I mean, it was just that, I was that disillusioned by my addiction. And so for me, the only thing that really got through to me over time was just knowing that there were other options out there, and knowing that my parents supported me, and genuinely when they would just say, we are here for you, and if you want to take help, we'll help you find help, but like we can't make you. It was almost like it was easier for me to know I needed help when it was just kind of suggested very softly, or when
right,
it was just made apparent.
Right. And the opposite was me, where I said to Chris probably about a year and a half ago or 2 years ago, I called him up one day and said, look, if I called you right now and told you I had breast cancer, but said, I'm not going to do chemotherapy, I'm not going to take care of myself. And he said, I know where you're going with this, and you can just forget it. Because what I was trying to get him to see was that he had a disease and that he wasn't doing anything about it. Because I was watching this spiral that was happening that as a parent was so heartbreaking for me. And, of course, I took responsibility before I went to Al-Anon for all of this, which we'll talk about Al-Anon later on. But that was – can we talk about the disease model for a minute? Because there's a lot of people out there who do not believe that this is a disease.
I didn't believe it was a disease until I got into AA. Nine months ago.
Oh, you didn't either, Chris? I thought you did.
Well, I didn't. No, when I was in AA when I was younger, I would hear it, but I was just like, I don't know if it's a disease. And then when I got back in this time around, I immediately thought it was a disease, but then I just struggled with, well, do I have it? And then, I just started going to more meetings again and hearing the same stuff that would just, like, completely outline me and my life. And I was like, okay, yeah, I totally have this.
Right. Right, and some people call it an allergy, right?
Yeah.
And so for you, Della, when did you decide you had this disease or allergy?
I didn't believe it was a disease until I got sober through Alcoholics Anonymous 9 months ago, because I thought I had control over it, was honestly what it came down to. I thought I was in complete control. And it took coming to AA and hearing other people's stories and being able to relate regardless of the circumstances and to have those same emotional reactions to my life thus far. And then the description in the big book and from my sponsor of how it's an allergy of the body and a mental obsession, and that it was something that regardless of the attempts I had made, I did try to quit several times, I couldn't resist. Ultimately, I would end up drinking or using, even if I promised myself I wasn't going to do it that day. So it really took a lot of education for me within the first 30 days of my sobriety. And part of that was I was seeking outside help as well through a psychiatrist. And I walked into her office one day physically sweating and shaking and nauseous. And I told her I thought I was dying because I tend to be slightly dramatic, and she told me that that was a withdrawal, that I was withdrawing from alcohol and drugs. And I and up until that moment, I did not believe that my use qualified.
Here's the thing that blows my mind. A year ago on Christmas Eve, Chris was at a family function with us, and they were having eggnog, and I saw him literally pour a half a bottle of Hennessy's into his glass with the eggnog. And I watched him drink it, and then I saw him go back and do it again, and he was perfectly fine. I mean, you would have never known he was drinking at all.
Right? Yeah, and for the record, I'm not a Hennessy drinker, but that's just how big of an alcoholic I am.
Okay. But here's my point. Chris, you never went through alcohol withdrawals, did you?
Not really. I was just always drunk.
I know you were drinking every day.
Oh, at the end? I could have gone for years without alcohol withdrawals. I mean, just because I had such a crazy tolerance for it.
Which is just incredible.
Plus, I was on a lot of other stuff. I mean, I was taking Xanax like 3 times a day, and I mean, if anything, I went on withdrawals from that.
Oh, you did? Oh, see,
yeah.
I never heard that when you stopped taking that.
But,
and what were they like, the withdrawals?
Oh, it was just very depressing, very like pretty physical too.
Yeah. Yeah, because it's amazing because I'm listening to Della talk about walking into the psychiatrist shaking. And the other part of this, ladies and gentlemen, that is very frightening to me is that my son was on psychotropic medications for bipolar and still drinking and doing Xanax and Coke and whatever else you were doing.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact
that
you never died is just amazing to me.
Mm-hmm.
So I want people to know how dangerous it is to be on those meds. In fact, I even emailed his psychiatrist, and this is your typical alcoholic, because I emailed your psychiatrist and then you stopped going to him.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Because you were upset that he knew what you were doing. And the reason I did that, and I probably shouldn't have done that because Al-Anon would probably smack me upside the head for doing it, was because I wanted him to know that I was terrified my son was going to die. But actually, Chris, I guess, could the two of you say that you didn't care if you died?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I have become so completely dependent upon the drugs and alcohol that, for me, living a moment without them was the worst agony I could imagine at the time. And so the idea that living without drugs and alcohol could look like that moment when I didn't have it was not worth living for. And drinking myself to death was also not really worth living for. So I was really caught between a rock and a hard place where I didn't necessarily want to keep drinking, but if I didn't, I was just miserable. And when I did, I was totally miserable. So it wasn't necessarily that I didn't want to go on living if I could, or if I thought I could live, you know, the life that I perceived everyone else around me to be living, which was normal, so to speak. But for me, I thought that my life was going to be miserable one way or another, and I didn't really want to go on living like that.
Well, one of the things that you told me, Della, that I'll never forget, is you had a friend that you started, I guess, AA with, and when he went out, I heard the story from you that when the two of you would drink together, you would say goodbye to each other.
Mm-hmm.
Because you didn't think you would be alive when it was over.
Right. Yeah, there were several times, whether it was, you know, just me being in pure drunken oblivion or me just being so depressed and miserable and not being able to reach the high that I wanted, where I didn't know if I was going to take too much and die, and I'd say, you know, bye to the people around me because I was going to take as much as I needed to feel what I wanted to feel. But at the same time, I you know, am not a complete idiot and realize that it was dangerous. But like I said a moment ago, it was miserable regardless, with or without, as far as I knew. And dying was definitely something that right up until the very end was definitely, I mean, my bottom for me was essentially deciding, I was at a place where I decided whether I was going to go get physical help from urgent care or if I was going to just let myself die.
Wow.
And for whatever, you know, reason, it took me a few lies to get there, but I ended up in urgent care. And it was just,
wow.
It was just really lucky, honestly, that I made that decision, or there was, you know, as they talk about in AA, some sort of kind of spiritual guide that led me to do that, because it really, it could have gone very differently had I sat another 10 minutes in the state that I was in.
Wow. So what led, Chris, what led you, I know the story, but what led you to AA? Back to AA again?
Yeah, well, I mean, you know the story very well. I was in the greatest place for alcoholics, Las Vegas. And, you know, I was there for 4 days. I remember maybe like 2 days of it, maybe.
And you were also gambling, right?
I was gambling. I had lost everything. And the only thing I had left was a Xanax bar and a bottle of tequila and $20. And my goal was to take that $20 and to win enough money to, you know, stay alive until my flight, which I was so fucked up when I bought the ticket. Oh, sorry. I mean, yeah. When
no,
I bought
okay.
the ticket, that I bought it for 2 weeks out. So I was going to be homeless in Vegas for about a week and a half. And, you know, the only thing that I found comfort in was that I had a bottle of tequila.
Wow.
And I was under this, I was in such delusion about everything. Everything, you know, in my mind, everything was still fine. I still had $20 to my name. And, you know, I honestly believed that I could turn that $20 into like $100 and then another, you know, then $200 and $300 when I had lost over a grand in a day.
Right.
And it's just, you know, and they talk about in AA how everything you can get addicted to, you can just classify it as alcohol. And one of those things for me is gambling.
Right.
It's just one another high, something that you chase. And,
right.
You know, I'm actually, now that I'm sober for a while, I look back at that and I think that finding gambling was actually a blessing, because it would have taken me so much longer to find the rooms of AA again. I might have not made it back.
Really?
Yeah.
Why? Explain that.
Well, because if I hadn't, if that whole trip had never happened, I would still be drinking. I would still be, you know, lying to myself, telling myself that everything was fine. But, you know, that whole incident just broke me down to the point where I really had a moment where I was like, you know, I think I have a problem. And a huge part of that was when you called me and you said, I know where you are. You're in Vegas. And I said, I know. I need help.
You did, which I
yeah.
started to cry because I
yeah.
hadn't heard that from you ever, ever. And I said, you're a liar. You're a gambler. You're an alcoholic. And you said, yes, I am. And you wanted to come home right away. And I couldn't afford to bring you home because it was the weekend.
Yeah.
So you sat for a whole day with no money.
I was getting like kicked out of hotels because I was drunk and I wasn't staying there. And I was eating McDonald's every 6 hours because that's all I could afford.
Mm-hmm.
And every time I passed the table, I was like, man, you should really go throw the rest of your money on black, you know? And I don't know what it was that kept me from doing that. I have no idea.
Yeah.
But, you know, then the saddest thing was when I got in a cab to go to the airport, I got in and then I told the driver I only had $12 and he got really pissed. And I was like, I'm sorry, dude, I lost everything. And he was like, well, this is my job. This is my job. And I was like, I know, man, look, take me as far as $12 and go and I'll walk the rest of the way to the airport. And I think at the end he felt really bad for me and he just took me all the way.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's kind of interesting that Chris brings that up because I feel like that I can relate. And it also links into the ADD really well, at least for me. My
mm-hmm.
alcoholism is so broad. And
mm-hmm.
I think that part of that is because anything that could become addictive, whether it was food or shopping or
mm-hmm.
alcohol or drugs, anything that could I could put some of my attention towards, you know, if I could spend more energy by having more addictions or more things to occupy my mind space and my time, therefore quieting my mind or leaving me with less energy, as I felt I had too much with the ADD. I didn't have any, you know, gambling in my story because I suck at gambling. But anything else, you know, like I still have little things I think that are part of just my attention. I have really intense OCD. I have, you know, I have shopping addiction. I have attention. I mean, just like getting people's attention, being the center of attention, it still all kind of relates to that spending energy, not having to necessarily just sit with my thoughts, and also something that I can do over and over and over again and not get bored. Just because otherwise I just feel like I'm staring at the ceiling, listening to myself talk. And although I talk often to many people, I don't really like hearing myself.
Really? Okay. It's funny. I don't listen to my podcast because I can't stand my New York accent. But listen, Della, so how did you end up in AA?
Honestly, I have been working as a chef for a family who had two parents who had gone through alcoholism, and one was in AA and one was not. And I had kind of gotten the lowdown from the niece of these clients who got me in touch with them about her family's story and the stuff they were going through. And so I kind of heard AA just in a social context. It kind of went in one ear and out the other, but something stuck because when I hit bottom, I knew exactly where to go.
What was your bottom?
For me, my bottom involved a car accident. I was high on antidepressants, anti-anxiety medication, and painkillers. I had been out on a drinking binge that weekend, and I'd run out of booze, so I took all of my prescription drugs. I still couldn't get the high that I wanted. It just wasn't working for me. I was obviously physically impaired, but I mentally was still very conscious and very paranoid and very uncomfortable. So I decided that I was going to get in my car and go buy some more booze and cigarettes, and I didn't make it to the store. I crashed into two parked cars. And I immediately lied to my parents, told them that there had been some sort of traffic incident involving other cars that had caused me to get in an accident because I was, you know, trying to do the right thing or some other BS. And my friend actually called my parents and ratted me out and said, no, she was intoxicated.
Wow.
And so that kind of brought the walls down. I mean, I really believed up until that point I had everyone fooled. And that I was managing everything just fine, and that no one had any idea I had a problem. And so for me, the car accident and my parents telling me your friend has let the cat out of the bag, I really thought that was the first time, you know, anyone, I mean, and that was a complete delusion also, obviously.
Right.
But I thought, oh, now, you know, the jig is up. Everybody knows. There's no point in going on. I'm totally at a loss. I can't get high. I can't get drunk. And I just started spinning and spinning and spinning. And inevitably, I drank two more tall boys and a bottle of wine. So at this point, I was those and three different pill bottles in. And I still was not getting the mental release I was searching for. And so I took to self-mutilation, and I cut my leg open 70 times. And when that also didn't relieve me, I realized I was in a pretty dire physical state, and I told a lie to a roommate to get her to drive me to urgent care, and at urgent care, the doctors and nurses were all crying. I mean, they were just in complete shock.
Wow.
They could not comprehend what was going on, and that was, to me, kind of my epiphany, and I was like, wow, I am in a really, really, really bad spot, and I need some help. And having heard AA somewhere back, you know, months ago, I knew where there was a meeting spot near my home, and I just kind of stumbled in there. And,
wow.
You know, I didn't have anything to lose and I didn't have anywhere else to go. And everyone knew that I had a problem as far as I knew at that point. And so if I didn't attend to it, really the joke was on me. So I just decided to do something about it.
It's unbelievable. That's the both of you have just incredible stories when it comes to, you know, I guess having that awareness or awakening of I've got an issue. And I guess I was kind of terrified when Chris did come home because he was going back up to San Francisco. He went to a couple of meetings down here, but I was really terrified that this wasn't going to be it. And I know he met you, Della, right away, which was a blessing, believe me, because I know the two of you have been very close. And you know, that's something I'd like you to talk about, because I hear a lot of kids talk about, you can't have any fun if you don't drink. You guys have fun without alcohol and drugs.
Oh, yeah.
It's definitely fun, but it is different. I mean, I recently went through like a good 48 hours where I was pretty miserable.
Wow.
I just felt really restless, irritable, discontent, and bored. I mean, that's another thing I struggle with my ADD today. I get so
bored.
I mean, like, especially because I don't have that same outlet. You know, I loved being able to get a buzz on. And, well, for me, it was really 0 to 100. So I was drunk as soon as I started drinking, essentially. But I love just going nuts, going totally crazy and letting all that energy out. And I didn't really, you know, care too much for a long time about the consequences, because it felt really good to just let out all that energy that I had been stuffing down.
How did you come through that 48 hours? What did you do?
I called your son and asked him to come hang out with me.
Great.
I mean, it's a combination of things, you know. It's knowing what you need. And for me, sometimes I need to go to meetings and I need to just vent and I need to get all of that icky, depressed stuff out in a group of people and have people be like, yep, we've been there. We understand. Sometimes I just need one person to kind of hug me and hold my hand and sit there. Because the thing that's the hardest, I think, is that for me in my alcoholism, I was a huge lover of the instant pleasure that drugs and alcohol brought me. I mean, as soon as you took something, you felt some relief. You know, it was always that instant gratification, as a lot of things in our world are geared today. You know, we're very accustomed to getting what we want as quickly as possible. And
it's called immediate gratification.
And that doesn't always happen in sobriety. There is a lot of waiting, and there is a lot of time watching. And so for me, it's a matter of finding things to do, and it doesn't always have to be completely different. I still go out to bars. I still go out dancing. I still go out to restaurants. You know, I still carry on socially to some degree the same way I would if I were drinking. Except I'm not ingesting anything to physically or chemically alter myself. But it's definitely having a good support system and being able to be honest with people and tell them how you're feeling and to be okay with not always feeling great and knowing that not everyone feels great all the time. And if they say that they do, they're complete liars and they're probably dealing with some demons that they're not ready to face. Mm-hmm. And, but, you know, that's the biggest thing for me is just having some commonality with some other human beings and knowing that.
Yeah, and I think that what you're saying is very true, because when somebody will tell you, oh, I'm great, everything's great, I got this, everything's wonderful, they're really, even in the mental health arena, they're really not being honest, because there's got to be times where they really just don't feel really good. And Matt and Rob, both ADD. Oh, we get somebody on the phone who wants to talk to you guys. They're from Palm Beach. Okay, so we're going to bring them on. Matt and Rob, both ADHD, recovering alcoholics.
Sure.
How's
Hi, guys.
It going, bitch? I'm high as fuck and drunk as fuck. The fuck are you going to do about it, bitch? Eat my bitch. I'd like to chemically alter your pussy.
Hey, that's not nice. Don't do that. Hey, I'm sorry about Matt's behavior.
I'm sorry.
Okay.
Sorry about that.
So, guys,
anyways,
you want to talk to Kristen Della?
Yeah, I apologize for his behavior. He's still going through the withdrawal. But we're down here in Palm Beach. I'm a recovering alcoholic here. I go to AA meetings. Lawyer covers it.
Cody.
And I also do have ADD, so there's, you know, I have a great compulsion to indulge myself, you know.
And that's part of the ADD. It's all about extremes.
Yeah, when I was in the car, I had these clementines, and I was looking at the clementine, and I was in the drive-thru, and I fell asleep. So, you know, that just gives you an idea of what I deal with on a day-to-day basis.
Okay. Do you
I
have
like
a
to
question?
Indulge myself in women's anuses. You interested?
Okay, Pat.
I heard
if you
like fuck yourself chemically.
Wait, hang on for a
minute. You want someone to hold you and hold your hand.
Yeah,
hey, guys.
Let's indulge your anus in chemical.
Hey, guys. Guys.
Hello.
Bitch.
You can't keep. If
Here's
you
Matt.
Guys can't keep,
Here's Matt.
Hey,
guys.
Are you the guy's
hey, honey, baby. Hey.
Just cut them off. Yeah, please. Hey. Thanks. Cut them off. Okay, they're gone. Sorry, guys. That was not good. Yeah, that was okay.
Wait.
What?
Does this happen all the time?
No. This is the first
How did they
time.
Even find?
This is the. You inspired crazy people to call the program. This is the first time we ever had to cut anybody off. Could you believe that? So you think those two were drunk or what?
I don't know if they were drunk or if they could just relate and wanted to, you know, get some attention. I definitely have pulled stuff like that before in the past. So
yeah, but they're gone now and they're not coming back because. I think they missed one of the steps.
Oh,
in recovery.
Man.
Yeah, they definitely missed one of the steps. Speaking of which, that's what is going to be my next thing is sponsors. Okay. So I know that when you started, Chris, you had one sponsor who was a great guy but just wasn't a good fit for you at the time. And you've got an incredible sponsor now. And I remember you telling me that it was very hard for you to go up to ask him because he said, if you're not going to stay sober, don't ask me to be your sponsor. And basically that was kind of a spiritual thing for you. So talk about sponsors and how important they are to your recovery.
I think they're tremendously important because the program is really the steps, and you can't go through the steps on your own. I mean, it's not I know you hear tons of stories of people trying to do that, but it just doesn't work. I mean, you need someone to take you through them. But you also need somebody. You also need somebody who's gonna be able to understand where you're at, and somebody who's been through not only their own recovery, but they've had a handful of sponsees that they've had to deal with from all different facets. So, I think it's better to find somebody with a little bit of time, who has some experience with with what you're dealing with. But
Can you talk a little bit about this? Can you talk a little bit about the steps? And I know that when I met your sponsor, he kind of explained to me that when you get through the steps, that's that spiritual awakening. Can you talk about that a little bit? Because people ask
me about that
a lot.
They call it an entire psychic change. So, meaning when you get through the steps, you know, you're going to have an entire new outlook on life and the way you view everything that you were doing in the past and, you know, number one, why you were doing it. And then two, how you're going to be able to come, you know, face those things head on, like stuff like being bored and sobriety or feeling like, you know, is this it? You know, cause I know a lot of people get to that point in sobriety where they start feeling like, is this all I'm going to be doing for the rest of my life? And I think that's a big part of where a sponsor comes into play because you need somebody to bounce that kind of stuff off of.
Right.
You know, you need somebody who's been through that and somebody who's
going to. And so what do you do when somebody says to you or you say, I'm bored, I need more than this? What would your sponsor say to you? Because I know bored is a big thing for people with ADD. We get bored very easily.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not something we like to deal with. And that was a big part of my drinking and using was, you know, when I would get to that place in the day where I'd be like, okay, well, this is kind of boring. Now let's turn it up a little bit, you know?
Right. And so what my question was, like, have you gotten there, and what has your sponsor said to you to make you help you through that time?
You know, my sponsor is really good about understanding where I'm at and kind of, you know, if I tell him I'm bored, he'll just be able to say, okay, you know, I get it. And, you know, he's the kind of guy that would probably suggest me reaching out to another alcoholic, because that's
okay.
Really the program is one alcoholic talking to another alcoholic about how to stay sober. You know, that's whenever I get to a place where I feel like my program is stagnant, I try to reach out and help somebody else and just get out of my head and stop making it all about me. And that's what we
do so much as
addicts and about people that have ADD. We spend so much time focusing on our problems and our lives and what we need, we forget that there's a billion other people that are going through stuff that we could possibly be able to.
That is so awesome. That is so.
Yeah.
That is it in a nutshell, and it's all about us being selfish and just caring about ourselves and focusing on us. But, you know, it's interesting. You talk about the both of you when you were younger and how fitting in the family and, you know, feeling like less than. And, you know, I had this happen to me today. I bought Mike's ticket. Mike is my other son whose birthday is today. Happy birthday, Mike. And I bought him a ticket to come home tomorrow. And when I made the reservation, I mean, I actually think this is pretty funny, but it's not from a money standpoint. I brought him from L.A. to San Francisco instead of San Francisco to L.A. And so to make a long story short, when I called the airline, I needed help. And it was, by the way, Virgin America. And Branson has ADD. He was in my book. So I was telling the woman that I was speaking to, who was a supervisor, and she said to me, you know, I said, do you have ADD? She said, no, I don't. My son does, but I hold him accountable for everything. And that set something off in me that brought me back to my own childhood of never feeling good enough. And I brought that up because I think that all of us, this is a gift. I mean, our creativity is off the charts. I know Dell is a chef, and you, Chris, I've seen you with your creative side, and what you're doing now is awesome. But think about going through school and having people say things to you like, take your medication, or as my name was stupid, lazy, and procrastinator. It tends to bring back all that negative stuff, and it hurts.
Right.
It's very painful. And for me, my drug of choice was food. So after I got off the phone with her this morning, I would have loved to have had a bowl of ice cream. I didn't.
Right.
But it hurt. It really hurt.
Yeah.
Because I was admitting to her that I made a mistake, and she was chastising me for that.
Right.
And so I was very concerned about that. Is that the guys again? Did they call back? Wait a second. Hold on for a minute. Hold on. Did they call back? Steve? Oh, okay. I thought it was the guys again. Somebody else had called, and I wasn't sure who it was.
Okay.
Anyway, so Della, is the whole sponsor thing the same thing for you that Chris was saying, how you have to have, you know, somebody that you can relate to and the steps and all that?
I definitely think that it's an essential part of the program. Once you get into doing your work, you definitely benefit from having a sponsor to share their experience with you, walk you through the steps, and kind of just guide you in your day-to-day battles with the alcoholism, the ism,
right,
as they call it. However, my experience has been slightly different. I didn't have a sponsor for the first 3 months I was in the program.
Wow.
And that is fairly unique and not usually recommended. However, I really wouldn't have done it any differently. I needed the time to accept my sobriety, to figure out who I was or who I thought I'd been and what I wanted to change. I needed the time to admit that I was an alcoholic and that I had a problem that I couldn't control.
Right.
And I needed the time to enjoy just being sober. I wasn't ready to jump into the steps and start doing the work. I'm the kind of alcoholic that if you start giving me tasks and start telling me what to do, I'm like, forget it. Not going to happen. I don't like any sort of structure. That's part of why I work for myself, and I work in a specialty that involves a lot of kind of creativity and on-the-moment creation. So for me, it was really, really beneficial to not have a sponsor for 3 months.
And that's
but
good.
I didn't do anything within the program in those first months either. I was going to meetings. I was talking to other alcoholics. I was relating. I was sharing my story. I was getting comfortable being an alcoholic, which I had never really fully admitted. I mean, I'd admitted it, but I'd never fully accepted. And so that, those 3 months were crucial for me to accept what I was about to embark on. But once I got a sponsor, I started working with her for a few months, and then I didn't like her because, you know, I'm me, and I think I know best, and she was telling me things I didn't agree with, and, like, that's fine, you know, and you know, you can change sponsors, and you can agree to disagree with people. It doesn't mean you have to all of a sudden conform to one person's perspective of AA or sobriety or life after drinking. So I got a new sponsor who I had a lot more in common with, and she and I work really well together. I still don't do it perfectly. I still don't call her every day as I'm supposed to. I still don't get all of my step work done on time. I'm only on the fourth step, and I've got 9 months, which is another thing I've found to be slightly uncommon. Usually people by 9 months, you know, or when they're approaching their first year of sobriety, they're, you know, on the eighth or ninth step. But, you know, everybody does it a little bit differently is all I'm trying to say, and that shouldn't be a deterrent for trying
it out.
But that's
okay. Yeah. I mean, Chris, I think you're in the same place, right?
Yeah, I'm still in the, I just finished my fourth step.
Okay. So, see, I mean, and I'm sorry, but I think
the last time
when you did it too fast when you were in.
Oh, yeah, the last time I went through it way too fast.
Right, with the Nazi.
Yeah, and you know what? I'm older now, and stuff happens. I mean, life happens. You know, I would be further along in the steps if my whole life was doing AA. But you know, I've had to integrate myself back into society in terms of a job and, you know, free time and you know, really just trying to live that in that middle line of having AA on one side and you know, and the rest of life on the other, and you just try to keep it balanced.
Right, and I think you've done a great
job.
So,
I was younger,
I think you've done a great job. I really do. I'm really impressed of what you've been doing. I mean, you know, the fact that you can call me up and say, yeah, you know what, I'm watching the game with some of my friends from Bubba's who I know are not sober, and I'm okay, but we'll get to that too because of Al-Anon. But I'm really impressed with who you are and what you're doing, both of you. I mean,
thanks.
I'm so impressed. Hey, I've got a guy that wants to talk to you, and he's a friend of mine that's on Facebook all the time. He's a great guy. His name is Tom Nardone. So can I put him on?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Hang on. Let me put Tom. Tom.
Hey, how are
you? How
you
doing? Good. You want to say hi to Chris and Della?
Yeah. Hey, guys. Chris and Della, really enjoying the show. I listen to Justine's show anytime I'm not at work and I'm home. And it's not just because of her New York accent, and it's not just because I'm just curious if she's going to mention my name at any point during the show. I actually enjoy it. I was just sitting here working on this project, listening to the show, and I mean that dude called in. I was like, what the hell just happened? Like,
oh,
I've never heard that happen on your show.
Oh my God.
I mean, I was like, what the, I mean, I thought there was something wrong with my TV, like a pop-up, you know, one of those pop-up commercials came on, but then when he was talking, I'm just like, what the hell is that? But,
you think they were a little drunk?
Steven gave him the steel toe to the ass, so that's nice that it all worked out that way.
Well, the only solace that we can take is that if their lives are coming down to pod surfing drunk and calling in to people's shows, you know, because they were in Palm Beach, I'm sure, it's 3 hours ahead of us. I mean, that if that's their lives, then that's hilarious. I'm glad they're on the
show. Steven, you have a far more mature attitude towards it than I do. I was actually quite jealous that no one like that ever called in, like, while I was a guest on the show. I really felt a little bit cheated, but My mom has actually, when I've been a guest on your mom's show, my mom has called in a couple of times, and she was an alcoholic for a long time, but I didn't really, as a kid, I didn't really know that, I knew she drank beer all the time, but I just figured that's just what adults did. And,
right.
It was kind of strange that, I didn't even really ever see it, but, I came home from the Navy on leave, and I saw, mom, she came home like 2 days in a row with a 12-pack, and I'm like, didn't she just buy a 12-pack yesterday? I'm
right.
Like, how does anybody drink that much? Forget what it is. How does anybody drink that much liquid in a day? I couldn't drink that much and anything. And she always bought the cheap stuff. But anyway, I kind of mentioned it to my dad, and, he just kind of didn't want to believe it. And I told Dad, I said, Dad, I'm just telling you, this is a problem, and what can you tell your dad? He's your dad.
Mm-hmm.
And,
right.
So I figure he knows my mom, and if it's, he said it's okay, it's okay. But yeah, and then she had a couple issues while driving, and it was she didn't get hurt, thank God, or nobody else, but that was kind of the end of that. But she actually has had a real struggle with it. And she just did recently, a couple months ago, I get her blue chip. That's for a year. Is that right? Is it blue?
Oh,
blue's a year.
Wow. So she's been sober for a year?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean,
wow.
She's gotten,
good for her.
Yeah, and she's gotten her, she's gotten her blue. She told me she's gotten her blue chip before, but
yeah.
Not
okay.
Legitimately, She didn't put it back in the bowl, I guess, when she went in there. She figured
right.
That was just going to be her little secret,
Right.
But, and, it was odd because, you hear about the 12 steps, it's on TV shows and whatever, but it was just weird this past May when I was down there for my birthday that, she actually said, step 9, I guess, making amends.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And I don't have any bad memories of her as a mom, as a child, she felt the need to make amends. So, I just said, hey, no problem. I forgive you and thanked her for doing it. It wasn't. I didn't feel it was necessary, but I figured, her doing that would make
her
feel better.
Yeah, it was
yeah,
for her.
And,
yeah.
Yeah. So, but boy, being ADHD on top of all that, that's. I don't know. I think my opinion is that being. There was just so many things I just wouldn't do because I was ADD, and but I didn't really ever want to do too much. But I think maybe the alcohol removes your inhibitions and things that you're maybe normally too timid or shy or afraid to do. And do you think
that
has anything to do with it?
Right, Chris?
Yeah. Oh yeah.
And Della,
oh, yeah.
You're like a superhero when your inhibitions are gone. There's things that you'll do that will impress people and give you the kind of attention that you so desire.
I found other
ways. My spare time is spent thinking of ways to whore myself out for attention. I've just found ways to do it that don't involve alcohol. But
right.
That's as your mother provides me with some of that when I'm on her show. So I appreciate it. But,
so Della, what
well,
are you
definitely saying? I got a nickname at my first college in Dallas, Texas, of Spidey Woman. Because I lived on the second floor of a brick building, and I would constantly lose my key card, and I would just scale the wall.
Wow! Wow!
I would climb up the brick to my window and let myself in that way, and I got fined for breaking my screen, over 10 times. But like you said, the ADD paired with the alcohol. I just was invincible. Like, I was going
to
get
I mean,
in my
who
room.
Wants to give up the title of Spidey Woman?
Yeah, I mean,
no one wants to give
I
that
have
up.
Had
I mean,
so
you
many
earned it, and it's like, you got to maintain it.
So, yeah, but definitely the alcohol just inevitably, my biggest problem was that the alcohol fueled my ADD. I mean, I just went so completely insane when I would drink or use. Nobody could put up with it, and no one had any idea what I was talking about or what I wanted to do, or people just ended up ditching me places because I was just a handful when I would drink or use. And so for me, it was just the perfect storm. I'd get a few drinks in me, and I was you know, running down the middle of the street in the middle of the night.
Well, and, you know, it's interesting because what Tom was just saying, I have a lot of kids that I see that will say that without alcohol or marijuana, they can't talk to other people. But that disinhibits them to the point where they can make friends, which is really, that's a scary thing. Because
yeah, we hear that a lot in the rooms.
Oh, yeah. You do. I know, absolutely. And and there was a time in my life when I had a little bit of a drinking problem, and I stopped right around Chris's age when I woke up one morning in somebody's bed and went, oh, geez, who is this, and how did I get here, and where's my car, and that was it for me. I was done because I couldn't do that. But see, that's the difference. But then with the food, I ended up in Overeaters Anonymous because I was 300 pounds. So, I mean, that's where the addiction part of the addiction comes from. And the other part of it is, and I think people need to know this, is the bipolar. Because in the in the DSM-5, it's right there. It's gambling, drinking, drug abuse. It's right there with the manic episodes that, you know, when they're not under control like yours are because of the medication. So that's the other thing that people who have bipolar, they stop taking their meds. Because the minute they start feeling normal, they don't like that. Oh wait! I want to feel manic again. You know, you have a son
people,
like that.
I'm sorry.
You have a son like that, right? That struggles with bipolar as well. So it's not a pretty thing to have. And but I think that everybody can, if you're on your meds, you can have a normal life. You truly can, but you've got to stay on those meds. You can't fool around with them. And it takes a long time to get
that
right
for me about. The thing that was hard for me about staying on my meds, though, is that I still craved that outrageous behavior. And so for me, taking any medication the way it was prescribed was virtually impossible. And when I did take it as prescribed, I felt totally zombie. I mean, I just didn't feel like I could relate at all to people, whereas I preferred that I couldn't relate to people because I was obliterated. So that was a difficult piece for me, was learning that you have to take medication as prescribed, and then you have to figure out how to conduct yourself in a somewhat quote-unquote normal fashion, and that's just life. You know, life is still going to happen regardless of the state you're in, and it's better to be as on top of things and able to handle life as it comes.
Right. And do you guys both think that it's kind of, as you get older, look, I know that this disease can, you know, run your entire life, but as you get older, is it a little bit easier to stay on the program because you're not 19 and 20? I mean,
yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
It's easier, but it's still, you know, I'm 26 and I still, you know, feel like, you know, I see my friends acting foolish and I don't necessarily get jealous anymore because they end up feeling terrible the next day. But there still is a part of me that's like, how can they go about doing that and maintain some quality of life when, you know, I couldn't do that. So there's definitely
they don't
a complex
have the disease.
That comes with it.
Right. They don't have the disease. And
would you ever bargain with yourself and tell yourself because you're older now, maybe you could because maybe you've outgrown it, maybe you're a little more mature now, and maybe you'll be able to handle it better? I'm not suggesting you could. I'm just wondering if that ever enters your mind.
No.
I definitely tell myself that. I try to remind myself, like, I'm 26, I'm getting older, and that's just not acceptable behavior anymore.
Yeah. Because I know
definitely being older has helped. Because I remember sitting on a lawn in college with my friend, and she knew that I had a problem, and she never pushed it on me. She's one of my best friends to this day. And just the fact that I could be open and honest with her, and I told her, I said, you know, listen, I'm an alcoholic, but I'm not ready to deal with it. And I was 22 maybe, and that was the first time that I think I ever admitted it seriously, but I still was like, but I'm still a kid, like I still want to fool around and be crazy, and so there definitely, for me, has been a component where age has played a significant role in me being able to just accept the fact that, you know, I have to change, and that that's not a bad thing, and that that's something that inevitably everyone does at some point in their life, whether it's, you know, starting to pick up or starting to put down things that are good or bad for them. You know, people have to figure out what their path is. And for me, age has been significant because I used to get a hangover before I even would go to bed. It just, you know, I was wow, this is just, and even sober now, I'm realizing things that I can and can't do that I would do anyway when I was drinking that are probably related to my age.
Yeah, and you know, there have been millions and millions of people that have been helped through AA. And I guess the question that I have that some people bring up to me, what do you do when you have somebody who's agnostic or does not absolutely believe in God? How do they do this program?
Well, you don't have to believe in God. I mean, the biggest thing for me, I had been exposed to religion as a child, and so when I came into the rooms, I was so desperate and willing that I didn't care if they believed in a God, if I was going to have to adopt a God. But for me, it's been hugely beneficial to just realize it's, you know, just something outside yourself, something that's bigger than yourself. And for me, it's just a belief that there's an energy that keeps the world going, that keeps the sun rising and setting, and that whether I like it or not, that's going to happen. And so just acknowledging some sort of energy outside myself that keeps everybody else revolving in this life
is
all that it really takes.
And Chris, what do you think? Is there something people can do when they come in? And
I mean, I'm dealing with this right now with a sponsee.
Okay.
And, you know, he's very agnostic. And, you know, I told him, you don't have to believe in God. You don't have to choose a religion. You just have to believe that there's something bigger than you keeping you sober.
Right.
It doesn't have to be an ultimate creator or, you know, a religious figure. It just, you know, it can be a lot of people when they get sober, they choose the universe, or they choose, you know, they'll choose like a mountain. Like literally they'll be like, that mountain right there, it's like bigger than me. And, you know, it's greater than myself. And then a lot of people, you can tell, you know, I told them too, I said, you can sit in a meeting and you can listen to these people share, and you can choose to pick this group of alcoholics if you want to be your higher power. I mean, it's just,
yes,
it just, you got to get to the point where the person can't think that they're doing it themselves, because they ultimately can't.
Right. No, they can't. And you know, I have to share this with everybody, and Tom is on the phone too as well. And I believe that this is directly from God, and I happen to be a spiritual person and have a very strong relationship with God, a lot of it being Al-Anon, which I want to get to before the show is over. But I found out the other day in talking to my sister, I mentioned to her that Chris's year anniversary is March 24th, and she was like, that's Daddy's birthday. It was my father's birthday. And I called Chris up and said, oh, my God. Was that crazy?
Crazy.
I that is directly from God. I mean, and the other thing you don't know is 24 is my lucky number. It's always been.
That's
and not
really funny.
Not a gambling thing. It's not a gambling thing. It's Steve's in the background laughing. It's not a gambling thing. It's like anytime I was at the airport and my flight had a 2-4 in it, I felt like I was going to be okay. It's just been my kind of lucky number my whole life. I don't know why. But it has.
Yeah.
And it just kind of hit me the other day, too, after finding that out. So I just want to spend a few minutes, and I don't know, Tom, how much you know about Al-Anon, but, you know, Al-Anon is kind of like the sisterhood of alcoholism, and it was started by Bill's wife. Bill and Bob started AA. And it's really for people who are dealing with the disease of alcoholism in their family. But it's not about dealing with the alcoholic. It's about dealing with yourself. It's about yourself getting better. And I've been going to Al-Anon now since 2007, on and off, since Chris started to drink and Chris went into rehab. And what I have found is that I have yet to find a sponsor. I've been to probably three people. Or four people, and it wasn't working for me because it just wasn't the right fix or mix, but I will find somebody. But I do go to meetings all the time, and it's really helped me to focus inward and to help me get better instead of worrying about Chris getting better all the time. And maybe, Chris, you could talk a little bit about how much that has helped you.
Oh, it's been awesome. I mean, I think it's a little bit of give and take. Like, you know, I'm at a place now where I think you feel comfortable with what I'm doing, and you back off a little bit, and then, you know, it honestly makes me want to want to call you and strengthen our relationship rather than, you know, how it used to be where I would dread you calling me.
Right.
Because
I was always asking you questions.
But, I mean, that was on me. So, Al-Anon, I actually want to start going to Al-Anon.
Really?
Yeah, because I feel like, you know, I still have so many codependent issues. And they talk about how you need a qualifier for Al-Anon. And, I mean, I'm around alcoholics 100% of my day. So, you know, I qualify. And I would love to go there and just explore more about, you know, what Al-Anon has to offer in terms of help my AA.
Right. I will tell you that one of the things that I do notice with Al-Anon is there have been people that have been there like yourself. You see them 30 years. And when I listen to the stories of the people whose kids are 39, 40 years old, and the kids are still living home and throwing hatchets through the front window, and the parents are still dealing with that, I'm like, okay, so when is this going to change, you know? Because
right.
I really believe that the whole enabling part of this is the thing that really hurts the alcoholic in the end. I mean, yeah. I know that the joke is that alcoholics hate Al-Anon because we don't enable and we don't allow you to manipulate and all that other stuff. But really, for parents, there's got to be that point. And Dr. Drew, who you love, Chris, I love, he's my favorite guy in the world, has said there are more kids who die in their own beds in their house than die in the street. Because instead of the parents throwing them out, they're allowing them to stay in the house and use drugs. So there's got to get to that point where you say, enough. Especially like you said to me the other day when I was talking about one kid in particular, you said, is this kid disrupting the family? I said, absolutely. Then if the kid's 19 years old, you got to make a decision. What are you going to do?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And so that's the other thing. Go ahead.
I was going to say, I just can't imagine that, you know, it's easy to sit here for me and to say that parents should do that. But, I mean, I know that's a tough decision.
It's very tough. It's very tough, to throw your kid out of the house and have them have to deal with that. It's
a gamble.
Especially kids that are shooting up heroin and, you know, because heroin is getting really big. And from what I understand, it's not as expensive as everybody thought. And it's terrible. It's an awful addiction. It's an opiate addiction, physical. And when you see your kid going through that, that's got to be just absolutely heartbreaking, you know?
Yeah.
So. Tom, are you still there?
Yeah, I'm sorry. Just what bothered me the first time my mom went into AA was it was actually around Christmas time, and you know, and I know my mom, she gets into AA, and it's, you know, I think one of the things they teach is that alcoholics, you know, they can't expect other people to change the course of their lives simply because they have an addiction with something, and being around people that drink is just a part of, you know, I guess. It's just going to happen, you know.
Right.
But I was really disappointed in a lot of my family members, a bunch of them. They weren't alcoholics, but while every one of them knows that my mother is in a program, then we go over to a family member's house for a holiday. And, you know, I go in there, and my uncle or somebody says, Tom, can I get you a beer? And it didn't even occur to me that there would be any drinking over there at Christmas time with my mom there. And it blew me away. And I just looked at him. And I looked at him and I said, no, are you stupid? And I could not believe that this was happening. I said, and then it was like the next year, you know, I get, you know, I mean, I probably drink a 12-pack maybe every 6 months. I mean, I rarely ever buy beer. But my brother or somebody got me one of my family members got me one of those little mini kegs of my favorite beer, which is Newcastle. And I opened it up, and I'm like, the whole family's in a circle opening presents. And I look up, and I said, you got to be shitting me. Who is this from? And no one said shit. It didn't have a tag on it. It didn't have a who is it from on it. I didn't really know who bought it. I opened it up and it's this keg. I said, who the hell bought this? What stupid ass, is this my gift? And then somebody gonna? Hey Tom, are you gonna tap that keg? And I'm like, I said, you know, you asked. It was somebody. He asked me about my medication earlier that night, and I said, you know, let's get back to that question. Makes me want to revisit the question you asked me earlier about what does my medication do for me. Apparently, it enables me to have conversations with people like you, because if I didn't take it, there's no way me and you would ever communicate. I couldn't deal with it.
No, I have to tell you, Tom, when Chris came home for Thanksgiving, I mean, we're not drinkers, okay? We're not. And I stopped drinking when Chris stopped drinking, so I haven't drank. But the point is that when he came home for Thanksgiving, there was nothing here. And I know that Della had a different situation. And my thing is, if your child is working on sobriety, you need to support, or anybody in your family, there needs to be that support, unless you're a raging alcoholic and need to drink that much. I mean, that's...
Well, yeah, it's like, if a kid's a diabetic, is his family going to take him on a summer trip to Willy Wonka's chocolate factory? No, it's just about courtesy. And using your brain. I mean, you have a brain. I mean, you use it, and that's how you don't do stupid shit like that. I mean, I just don't get that.
Well, I will comment on this because I've talked a lot to Justine and Chris about my family. Both of my parents are very heavy drinkers, and that was a huge struggle for me when I decided to get sober. You know, I was like, how in the hell am I going to interact with my family? And to this day, they still drink around me. I pour their drinks, actually. I was home for Thanksgiving, and that was one of the biggest problems I had. You know, my dad jokingly calls me garçon now because he has me getting his drinks for him. And it's the same. It's why I'm not going home for Christmas this year, because I have to realize, similarly to being self-employed, I'm the only one who's going to keep me sober. And as irritating as it might be, and as, you know, as I realize that my parents live on their own island where that's totally acceptable behavior, and that, you know, they're in their late 60s and they're going to drink and they don't really give a shit what I think, you know, I have to realize that I have to now give a shit what I think, and that includes me making the decisions about what environments I'm going to put myself in and where I am and am not comfortable, and making sure that doesn't jeopardize my sobriety. And I, you know, I can get mad at them and I can think that they're stupid and that they're insensitive or whatever. And although I may feel that way 50% of the time, the other 50% of the time, I have to be really grateful that I'm in a place where I can say that or think that now and then make a decision that's healthier and better for me.
Good for you. Because
I can't control the world. That's a huge thing that AA has taught me. You know, I cannot control what anyone else is going to do. And,
no, you can't. But let me say something to you. The two of you, when you guys were going to the World Series and go Giants because they were amazing, you went to bars and you were hanging out and having a great time and watching people get drunk and all that. Here's the thing. That's one thing. But I'm sorry. Your family needs to be supportive. It's like what Tom was talking about. Somebody gives him a Christmas present in front of his mother that's a keg of beer. I mean,
it's totally outrageous. I believe that it's I think that it's very inconsiderate, and I think that it's I definitely wouldn't conduct myself that way if I knew somebody else in the room was sober. And I frankly told my parents when they insisted on Justine and Chris coming over, you know, during Christmas time and again during our New Year's. I said, you know, they and I are not comfortable being around people that want to drink.
That's right.
And
I was praying to God that we could have made the Michigan game, because I was hoping that your dad or mom would have said, "Would you like a drink?" And I would have said, "Are you fucking kidding me? I don't drink in front of my son. I mean, and I don't drink anymore. So what the hell is this about?" See, and Steve was really happy we didn't go, but I would say that, because to me, that's just ridiculous. That's how direct I am about things like that. I will support Chris to the day I die for what he's doing, because I have so much respect for him and you, Della, and you know how much I love you. You have been a savior to me as well. I have the utmost respect for the two of you, and for the hard work that you have put in on yourself. And so what? I'm going to screw that up for the sake of having a glass of wine? No, I don't think so. And Chris knows that if I wanted to have a glass of wine when he wasn't around, I'm not an alcoholic, so it doesn't matter. But the bottom is I am always going to support him in front of him, 150%.
I told another story recently in the rooms where I had about 30 days of sobriety, and my mom had invited me to some fancy schmancy cocktail party, and she asked me if it would be too inconvenient or uncomfortable for me to hold a glass of wine while I was there so that I didn't seem odd.
Are you kidding me?
They, you know, it's just, it kind of comes down to, you know, just, I mean, there's no way that I can really rationalize that in my head. In my mind, that's a complete misdirection of their love and support. They don't, they
it's
just,
a, it's a,
there's many,
I
mean,
I would have carried around a glass of
that.
My own urine all night and walked around. Just so that never, ever have, just to make the point that clear thinking must in the end prevail.
I mean, it's definitely something I struggle with, but it's, you know, and I've talked to them about Al-Anon, I've talked to them about podcasts, I've talked to them about educating themselves, and, you know, they always say, yeah, of course, but, you know, I can't make them do anything, and, I mean, it's a really good growing up lesson for an alcoholic, because one of the things that I wanted more than anything in the entire world was to never grow up. I mean, that was another reason I drank so much. I mean, I loved being, you know, the problem, the kid, the one that needed to be taken care of. I really did.
The attention.
Exactly, the attention. I needed everyone's attention constantly. I mean, my dad has asked me multiple times what he's supposed to do now because he doesn't have to clean up after me. And it's, you know, it's just,
tell him to try AA.
I get to be an adult. I get to be an adult. I have to... Yeah. You know, decide not to go home and spend Christmas with my family. I mean, that's not an easy decision. It's definitely not something that in my ideal world I want to do. And I hope I don't have to do it forever. But as long as my parents stick to having 5 drinks every single night, I cannot be in that environment.
No.
It's not because I'm tempted to drink. It's just because, to me, spending time with your family should be about connecting on an emotional and mental level that's just not available when someone is drinking to that extent.
No, that's exactly right. And I just have to say, because we have about 2 minutes, and I want to have the two of you back again, if you would, sometime, because this was such a powerful show, and we have a lot more that we could talk about. I do want to mention that Tom is starting his own podcast. And, Tom, when is that starting?
Actually, it was a secret, but as long...
Okay, well, I just blew
classic,
that one for you, Tom. I'm sorry. That's ADD,
I just didn't
Tom.
Want people bugging me about it. Not you, but I mean, just, hey, Tom, because I don't know when it's actually going to happen. I'm just playing with you, Senior Fun. I kind of think you're such a giving, wonderful person. I knew you were going to mention it anyway. I should have said something, but it's not a
absolutely.
Big deal.
Now, I'm excited for you.
It's going to be the Tom Nardone show, and I was going to call it the Tom and Sometimes Yvonne show. Because I don't know if Yvonne's really going to commit to it, because she's not the whore for attention that I am. So I really can't say for sure that she'll do it all the time. But it'll be great when she is. And it's basically just going to be like, you know, kind of following the same kind of attitude my blogs do.
And
Tom, there's so many things that I've written that Yvonne doesn't agree with. We're going to argue about it on the air.
Just for Chris and Della to know, because we have to hang up soon in like 90 seconds, is Tom's very funny. He's hysterical, as you can tell. And he helps helps so many people with ADHD because of how he approaches it, which is just great. So I wanna tell the both of you, Chris and Della, how much I love you. I appreciate you doing this so much. And admiration.
It was a lot of fun.
Doing.
Thank you so much.
And I would love it if
I'm digging, and Chris, I really dig the ADD, the Miss ADD theme song, man.
That was Mike.
That's
my other song.
Well, tell Mike, Chris.
I will.
Mike, that I really like it.
I will.
Thanks, Tom. Hey, guys, thank you so much.
You see how I slid out of that so smoothly?
Yeah, great.
All right. It was fun to talk to you guys. Thanks.
You too.
Thanks, Tom. And listen, guys, have a great night. Thank you so much for being on.
Yeah.
Awesome. Thank you.
And I'll talk to you soon, okay? I love you.
Okay. All right.
Love you. Bye.
Bye. So for those of you who are still listening, I want to tell everybody to have a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year, because next Sunday there won't be a show. We'll replay another one. This was a great show. Thank you, Chris and Della and Tom, for calling in. And those guys from Palm Beach, I really hope you get yourself some help. But I guess it was a little bit of comic relief. Not really, because I didn't like what they were saying. So I apologize if that offended anybody. So have a great day. Have a great night. And please remember to stay in the moment.